I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. The wave of foreclosures hitting many American cities are challenging many communities to wonder, what's next? Can these neighborhoods be revived, and if so, what will it take? Those are questions we'll ask Alan Malik, whose new report on managing neighborhood change comes just at the time when many communities are needing that help. We'll also talk about a subject that may at first seem far removed from cities, but actually is at their center. Our guest is Dr. Donald Johansson, a paleoanthropologist whose discovery 30 years ago of Lucy set him on a lifelong study of human evolution. That's today on Smart City, right after the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Alan Malik is Senior Fellow of the National Housing Institute and author of many works on housing and planning, including his latest, Managing Neighborhood Change, A Framework for Sustainable and Equitable Revitalization. He served almost a decade as Director of Housing and Economic Development for Trenton, New Jersey. Alan, what is sustainable and equitable revitalization?
Well, sustainable and equitable revitalization means when you're trying to change a neighborhood, and basically we're talking about changing neighborhoods and communities, is creating change that will last, that's not based on speculation or some kind of short-term fix that won't last, but change that is really grounded in fundamental values, whether it's market values or social values in the community, is what I mean by sustainable. And when I talk about equitable, I'm talking about change that doesn't just benefit the more affluent part of the population, but benefits everybody, so that the low-income residents of a neighborhood benefit from the fact that property values are higher and the neighborhood is seen as a more desirable place to live.
You say that the most powerful lever for neighborhood change is change in the demand for housing in the neighborhood. Why?
Well, it goes back to kind of a basic principle of consumer choice. If people want to live in a particular house or a particular neighborhood, they will value it more. And what happens in a neighborhood, and you see this in a lot of inner city areas, if you have a neighborhood where basically nobody actively wants to live, and the only people who are there are people who have few alternative choices, and anybody who makes a little bit more money or gets a slightly better job gets out the moment they can, that neighborhood is not going to be a healthy neighborhood because nobody has a commitment to that neighborhood. Nobody's chosen to live there. So basically, housing demand reflects consumer choice, and it's by making a neighborhood a place where people actively want to be and actively choose to be over other neighborhoods where they could also live, that you start to get positive change in the neighborhood.
In your new paper, Managing Neighborhood Change, A Framework for Sustainable and Equitable Revitalization, you make the case for understanding the different neighborhood types so that the right actions can be taken at the right time. I want to ask you about three critical transition points in neighborhoods. First, when are conditions right for jump-starting new development?
You can do something at almost any point, but the question is really what? So let's start out with you have a neighborhood that is really deeply disinvested, and you think about areas in North Philadelphia or East Baltimore, where there's a lot of abandonment, a lot of vacancy, very low housing values. Now, you could create new development in that area, but if you want it to have an impact, it has to be on a large enough scale so that it actually transforms the character of the neighborhood. Now, if you had a neighborhood that had more of a fabric, more of a market, you might be able to have an impact by doing smaller scale infill housing or rehab. So you can do something at any point, but what you do has to be sensitive to where the neighborhood is at.
How do you know what scale is right?
Well, it's not a science. That's one thing about all of this, is it there's a tremendous amount of judgment involved. And the judgment here, it's really on what would it take to move the market? And if you have an area where the market is really non-functional, the question is how many units are enough? It could be a few hundred in many cases, because what you're talking about is something where you're actually creating a different character than what's there now. You're not building on an existing character, in which case you could do something much more modest, but you're actually trying to create a new character. In some small towns, it might be a smaller number, maybe 50 or 100. In a large city, in a large urban neighborhood, it would probably be a few hundred units that you'd have to do.
And what actions help get development started in those neighborhoods where the market is simply not working?
Well, if you're talking about an area where you really are trying to create large-scale transformative development, what you really have to start out with is a process of starting to think about what else goes into that package besides the housing units themselves. Because, you know, a neighborhood isn't just housing. It's a whole environment for people. So what you may want to do is plan for a new park or improving a park or perhaps a new light rail line connection or other things that are going to complement it and increase the attractiveness and the desirability of the housing once you build it. Because, again, people don't just choose a house. They choose a community.
In your paper, you say there are three basic ways to jumpstart a neighborhood. Increase the housing desirability, increase the stability of the neighborhood, and increase the value of the amenities in the neighborhood. What strategies will increase the desirability of the housing stock?
If you don't have the kind of physical properties that people want to live in, then you're not in the game. But having the properties is not enough, because there are at least two other factors that are absolutely critical. The first thing is that people have to feel that they're getting decent value for their money. And this is particularly true if they're going to put money into rehabbing a house. Now, one of the things that I think is amazing is there are thousands of people in this country who, for whatever reason, have a yen to fix up old houses to live in them. But they're only going to do that if they believe that they'll get the money back that they're putting into it if they end up selling the house. So they have to be convinced that the market value of what they'll end up with is at least pretty close to the amount of money they put into it. So that's another part of making the housing stock desirable, making people feel that that house is a good business decision for them. And a third piece, one of the things that's a real problem for a lot of urban areas is the fact that people in the region and people moving into the region don't get good information about the urban options, and they often end up in suburban locations by default.
And what about increasing the stability of the neighborhood?
All of these things are interrelated. When I talk about neighborhood stability, I'm talking about influencing those factors that basically affect the value of somebody's investment in the neighborhood. So, for example, if you have a lot of abandoned houses in a neighborhood, they devalue the other properties. Similar is the amount of property improvement going on or not going on. Crime is a huge factor in terms of neighborhood stability. All of these things interact with this underlying issue of the market and how do you move it.
When you think about the amenities package that can add neighborhood value and stability, which amenities pay off the quickest?
I'm not absolutely certain, but if I had to guess, I would say that probably light rail. And in fact, it's interesting that I was in LA last week, and I was shown they're building a light rail line from downtown LA into East LA, which is an area that's very distressed and historically has been seen as almost not really part of the city. And even though the light rail isn't open yet, there's already been a dramatic change in property values and investment and development proposals in areas close to the new stations. I think parks, especially if they're connected to things like lakes and rivers, can have a tremendous payoff. Water bodies, again, seem to have a remarkable effect on people and on property values. I know in Baltimore, in the Patterson Park neighborhood, restoring this Victorian park was a major element, not the only one by any means, but a major element in turning that neighborhood around.
I'm wondering if there are tricks you can use to signal that a neighborhood is improving.
If you have a neighborhood that looks good, if the yards and the houses look good, I think people will react very differently to that neighborhood Another thing that's, I think, often underestimated is the idea of actually going out and marketing your neighborhood, and especially if you have a neighborhood that might appeal to a particular population, a particular niche, if you will, in the market, and going out and reaching them and drawing them into the neighborhood. And there's some really interesting examples where neighborhoods, sometimes on a shoestring, have gone out and basically promoted themselves and started to draw a market.
At the very beginning, rather than when the evidence is apparent.
Again, it's not a science. There's never any exact point you can look at. I would say one important step is when you start to see private developers, contractors, builders going in and putting up houses without any help from the government. That's a significant indicator, because that means at that point there really is money in building new houses. Now, that doesn't mean that you can sort of forget about that neighborhood and figure it'll take care of itself. You know, the values may be speculative. There may be people in the neighborhood who live in substandard housing that isn't going to be fixed up by the private market. There may be a need for additional amenities. At that point, you have to look at what has to be done to make the improvement in this neighborhood sustainable.
A second transition is when a neighborhood is about to tip. When do you know that a neighborhood is likely to tip from one that needs a lot of help to one that the market can take care of?
When a neighborhood overheats, that's when you start to see property values just taking off. And often that may not have to do so much with the neighborhood itself as with the whole regional housing market. Like, for example, the recent boom that is in the housing that is no longer with us. I mean, there were some urban neighborhoods where properties were going up at 20-25% increase in value each year. And that wasn't really based on sustainable improvement in the neighborhood. It was based on essentially speculative increases. You have to really look and see what's driving the increase. One of the things to really look out for is the extent to which property values are being pushed by speculation, by people flipping their properties as distinct from people making a personal investment to live in a neighborhood.
Make the distinction between overheating, as you've just described, that's driven by speculators and flippers, and price increases that are driven by people who have a genuine desire to live and in the neighborhood and contribute, that can still drive out renters.
Now, I don't think of gentrification as overheating, because in fact it could be based on good, solid economic fundamentals. But what happens when that starts to happen in a neighborhood is, as you say, there's this tremendous pressure being placed on the people who already live in that neighborhood. So the issue, to my mind, is not to try to prevent gentrification when it's truly based on people choosing that neighborhood to live in and investing their time, money, and energy in that neighborhood, but to figure out how to manage it in order to maintain housing and opportunities for less affluent people who've lived there before.
How do you manage gentrification?
Well, this is not easy. And sad to say, I think it's often more talked about than done, because I think there are a lot of very serious political as well as economic pressures that make it difficult. How you manage it is by focusing, I think, on two basic strategies. The first is trying to preserve and, in many cases, create housing that is affordable and is not subject to market pressure. We were talking about low-income rental housing through the tax credit program or other kinds of housing. And the second is to have rules in place that minimize or hopefully prevent involuntary displacement. Now, I don't believe, if we talk, go back to the renters you mentioned, most renters move. In fact, the average length of stay for a renter in an urban community is about 2.5 years. So we're not trying to freeze a given number of renters in place. What we're trying to do, though, is to create situations where they cannot be forced out against their will. And there are a lot of things you can do around those lines. So, for example, Washington, D.C. has a city statute that basically gives the tenants in a building a right of first refusal to buy their building if the owner puts it on the market. And quite a few buildings have been preserved as affordable housing. There's a growing support system in the district for tenant groups who want to do this in terms of helping them organize, helping them find the necessary financing and subsidies. Another thing that you could do is have, just as I think New York City does, if units are going to be converted to condominiums, that sitting tenants have the right to remain indefinitely as tenants until they leave, and then the unit can be occupied or sold. So there are a whole series of steps that you can take. Another one, going back to the idea of creating affordable housing, if you have a neighborhood where the market is strong enough and people are building expensive new housing, you can enact an inclusionary ordinance where you're now telling developers, if you want to build new housing in this neighborhood, you have to set aside 10% or 20% of the units as affordable housing. And in the last decade, inclusionary ordinances have been enacted in Denver, Chicago, Stamford, Connecticut, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and many places. So there are a lot of tools that you can use to manage gentrification and preserve affordable housing. But again, there are some very heavy political issues that come to bear when you start to explore those tools.
Who should be protected and who shouldn't be? If you're attempting to revitalize a neighborhood and increase value and presumably command prices that reflect that increased value, how much gentrification is acceptable?
I think they're very difficult issues. And again, it's very hard to find a straightforward answer that works across the board. Now, I know one neighborhood which is experiencing gentrification in an American city where the head of the local CDC has said, we don't see any need to build any more affordable housing because something like 35% of all of the housing units in this neighborhood are already affordable housing. They're basically locked into long-term or permanent affordability, and that is a good mix. And I think if you think about sort of broad statistics for a second, roughly 25% of the American population has an income of 50% of median or less, which is what the Department of Housing and Development defines as very low income. Now, those incomes, that's quite a bit more than poverty, but it's still pretty low income. So if you had neighborhoods where 25% of the housing was affordable housing for that population, that would probably be a fairly healthy mix. Now, when you start out in a low-income neighborhood, clearly a lot more than 25% of the people who live in that neighborhood are going to be low-income people. Navigating that process of change is going to be very difficult. And one other thing, if you have a neighborhood, for example, in a city where the market is appreciating all over the place and affordable housing is becoming at a premium throughout the city and throughout the region, then you might want to increase your goals in terms of producing affordable housing in this neighborhood that may be gentrifying. If you're talking about a neighborhood in a city where most of the city is still very affordable, then it might not be as important to produce more affordable housing in this particular gentrifying neighborhood. So again, finding the balance and the how much is enough is a very complicated, and again, it's a politically fraught issue.
And our recent attempts to push home ownership onto people have not worked out so well.
One thing, and I hate to say this as a long-term affordable housing advocate, you can have too much affordable housing, too much low-income housing in a neighborhood. I mean, if you think about the last 10 years, I mean, there have been some very good ownership programs being run by local governments and CDCs around the country, where they've really worked to make sure that the units were of high quality and affordable to the low-income home buyers, and where they provided those buyers with enough preparation, counseling, and so forth, so they knew what they were getting into. And those are truly benefits for the people who live in them and for the neighborhoods. But on the other side, what we did, we as a society, as an economy did, in terms of turning loose the subprime monster under the guise that this was going to benefit low-income families and low-income neighborhoods, was just short of criminal. And we're paying the price.
As you completed this work, what was your biggest takeaway?
My biggest takeaway was that it really is possible for, whether it's CDCs, local governments, other nonprofit institutions, it is possible to manage this process of neighborhood change in a way that is truly beneficial for the people in the neighborhood, for the neighborhood as a physical space, and for the community. It's not easy. In fact, it's tremendously difficult, and I think it requires a lot of sophistication and a lot of very careful long-term work, but that it is possible to manage this process in ways that benefit everybody. And I think it's really important to me to get that out and to try to encourage as many people in American cities to explore this stuff.
Alan Malik is Senior Fellow of the National Housing Institute. The latest news in the world of urban planning, design, and development comes to us from PlanEdison Assistant Editor Nate Berg.
Getting hit by a tornado can be pretty lame. A huge Category 5 twister creamed the city of Greensburg, Kansas last year, destroying almost everything in town. Left with piles of rubble scattered around the town and virtually everything in sight devastated, the people of Greensburg decided to come back in a major way. A recent piece from National Public Radio looks at the city's recovery efforts, which are underlined by the city's decision to rebuild green. Officials are hoping to achieve the LEED Platinum green building certification for the entire city. 1 year after the tornado, new wind turbines have been built to provide power, a handful of houses are being rebuilt, and the city's first store just reopened on Main Street. Greensburg's ambitious green plans are being lauded across the country, and many cities are watching the recovery process closely to see what can be learned from this small town's attempt to become the greenest city in the U.S. And while Greensburg hopes to transform itself from a devastated wasteland to a model green city, community activists in central Los Angeles are making efforts to transform some of the city's drabbest public spaces into cozy living rooms. An article in the New York Times looks at the efforts of activists and landscape architects to bring furniture to the streets of LA. Residents have been working with designers to build and install furniture pieces on neglected street corners and near heavily used bus stops. At 15 different locations around LA, benches, tables, ottomans, and other common furniture pieces have been built, creating what are being called community living rooms. The nonprofit group Central City Neighborhood Partners has plans for 7 more community living rooms, which they hope will make spending time on the streets and waiting for the bus a little more pleasant for people in these often ignored parts of town. And finally, in New Jersey, an environmental group formed by high school students was recently turned down by their school's principal when the group offered to donate a bicycle rack to the school. The New Jersey Star-Ledger reports that students at Bridgewater-Raritan High School had raised more than $2,000 in the last 4 years and were hoping to donate a bike parking rack as a way to encourage fellow students to bike to school. The principal reportedly turned down the offer, stating that promoting the riding of bicycles to school, quote, doesn't make sense. Despite a mass student bike ride held in protest, the principal still refuses to accept the rack. Disappointed members of the environmental club will have to continue chaining their bikes to a fence behind the school. Meanwhile, their fellow students will continue to park their cars in the school's parking lot, where the school has a dedicated parking spot for every senior that drives to school. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor for Planetizen.com. After a short break, we'll talk about human origins and evolution with Dr. Donald Johansson, the man who discovered Lucy. You're listening to Smart City. Listening to Smart City, I'm Carol Coletta. Dr. Donald Johansson is a rock star in the field of paleoanthropology, thanks to a well-timed look over his shoulder. He's the man who discovered Lucy, the world's best-known fossil, whose story is told in his book, Lucy, The Beginnings of Humankind. Dr. Johansson is director of the internationally respected Institute of Human Origins, a human evolutionary think tank he founded in 1981. His work has led him to undertake field explorations in Ethiopia, Tanzania, Egypt, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Eritrea, and most recently, Iran. He's co-authored 6 books now available in 10 languages and has published in the National Geographic magazine and in innumerable scientific journals. Dr. Johansson hosted and narrated an Emmy-nominated 3-part PBS Nova series entitled In Search of Human Origins. Don, you've written, understanding who we are is not just a matter of idle curiosity. It is a matter of survival for our species, as well as for the millions of other species with whom we share Earth. For without a clear understanding of who we are, we will fall far short of the kind of future we want for ourselves and for our children. How can a better understanding of who we are guide us to a better future?
Well, I think that the work that I've had the privilege of doing for the past 35 years or so in Africa has enlightened me about our place in nature. So often, living in modern cities, skyscrapers, and environments that are so far removed from the natural world, we tend to forget how closely connected our origins are to the very natural world around us. And we tend to take so much from that natural world without even thinking about the impact that we're having on it. We're fishing the oceans out, we're destroying tropical rainforests, we're damaging the very Mother Earth that was responsible for who we are today. And I think that we really need to reinvent a reverence for that very natural world and protect it, because ultimately the survival of Homo sapiens, supposedly wise man, depends on how well we take care of the very earth that created us.
But how does your work make the connection between us and nature?
Well, when we look back on what I call the human career, the last 4 or 5 million years, we find lots of links to that natural world. We sometimes refer to them as missing links. Scientists really don't like to do that. But every time we find a fossil like Lucy that I found in 1974, I see that as a link to the natural world. It reminds us that we have a common origin with all life on this planet, that the very factors that have brought about the diversity of all the species alive today, all of those that have gone extinct, are the same processes that have brought us to where we are today. And the fossils that we find are a stunning record of our very earliest origins, when we were much more closely tied to the natural world. I suspect that Lucy, who lived 3.2 million years ago, was very closely tied to the world around her. She made her everyday living by foraging and collecting and exploiting that world around them. And because of the way that she interacted with that environment, she survived. She left offspring. Her descendants ultimately evolved into us. And as a species today, Homo sapiens, We are all interested not only in our own survival, but the survival of our children, our grandchildren, and indeed this incredible globe that we live on that we call planet Earth.
What was the significance of your discovery in 1974 of Lucy?
Lucy was an extraordinary glimpse into what our ancestors looked like more than 3 million years ago. In 1974, we had very, very few fossils that were older than 3 million years, and we really didn't know who they were, where they lived, how they lived, or what they looked like. And Lucy turns out to be a very pivotal species. She belongs to that tongue twister called Australopithecus afarensis. That's why we call her Lucy. I think it's a little easy to remember. And Lucy really sits between very ancient, very primitive ancestors, ancestors that we would have a lot of difficulty separating from the apes. They might have walked occasionally from time to time on two legs, but they still looked very, very much like an upright ape, like a chimpanzee, for example. Lucy was the important bridge between these very ancient ancestors and much more modern ancestors, ancestors that were beginning to make and use tools, ancestors that were beginning to experience significant brain expansion. And in addition to that, she showed us that the very first things that changed after our separation from a common ancestor with the African apes was the fact that our ancestors began to walk upright. Long before we began to get big brains, long before we made stone tools. And it means that the freeing of those forelimbs that we now call our hands and arms were a very important event that allowed us to begin to manipulate the world around us in a very different way, to carry large amounts of food back to a central base where it was shared with our mates and offspring. So this was a crucial event in the human evolutionary story.
How did you find it?
Well, I was directing an expedition in northeastern Ethiopia along with some French colleagues. It was the 24th of November, 1974. Sunday morning, I was out surveying in this desert landscape. It really looks like the badlands of North America. Bones had laid in sort of suspended animation for millions of years. They were fossilized where they died millions of years ago, and now rainstorms are beginning to erode these fossils out on the surface. And as I was walking back to my Land Rover, I looked over my right shoulder, and there was a little piece of arm bone, no longer, about 2 inches long, I guess. And it is your elbow. When you flex your arm and you look at your elbow, that's the bone that was sticking out. And I knew from the anatomy of it, from the shape of it, that it belonged to a human ancestor, that it wasn't a monkey, it wasn't an antelope, it wasn't any other kind of animal. And when I kneeled down to get a closer look at it, I looked to the side, and there were parts of a skull, parts of a rib cage, parts of a jaw, and I realized that this was an extraordinary discovery.
So you didn't have to dig for it. It was exposed?
That's right. If you've ever been to the Badlands in the Dakotas, it's a vast area, much like it is in Ethiopia, and there are no signs that say, dig here. If you're an archaeologist working in North America, for example, you might look for potsherds or artifacts on the surface, arrowheads, and that would tell you that this is a good place to dig.
What can we know with certainty about our origins?
Well, we have a pretty good picture now. Over, I would say, roughly the last 4 to 4.5 million years, the evidence suggests to us, and this is comes from very different directions. It comes from the fossils. It comes from our genetics. It comes from our anatomy. We know that we shared a common ancestor, as Darwin had predicted in the late 1800s. A common ancestor with the African apes, and most particularly with the African apes known as chimps. Chimps and humans differ by only 1.2% in our DNA. So it means that ancestor was fairly recent. When I was a graduate student, by the way, at the University of Chicago, there were many people who thought that the separation was 15 to 18 million years ago. Now it looks like it's closer to 5 or 6 million years ago. So we know we shared a common ancestor with the African apes. We know that ancestor lived somewhere between, say, 4 and 8 million years, to be generous. And we know that the first thing that happened was that on the human line, we began to stand up and walk on two legs. Beginning around 3 million years ago, we see a divergence into a number of different branches on the human family tree. And some of those branches, most of them led to dead ends, like the Neanderthals or a certain kind of relative of Lucy's known as a vegetarian Australopithecus. Most of those lineages went extinct. stone tools appeared about 2.6 million years ago. Big brains appeared about, I would say roughly 2 to 2.5 million years ago. And Neanderthals appeared about 250,000 years ago. And you and I, Homo sapiens, appeared around 200,000 years ago.
From your perspective, what is the debate over evolution really about?
Well, I think the debate about evolution is really about the fact that most people who do not take the time to sit down and kind of understand evolution find it very confusing, very complicated, very hard to fit into their everyday lives. And so often people will just say, oh, that's just too complicated for me. I don't want to spend any time with it. But if people do sit down and read some, not only of my books, but there are many, many books out there that explain in a layman's term that this really is a very robust, a very strong, a very powerful theory that explains natural life as we see it, whether it's bugs or plants or humans or dogs or cats or whatever. And I think that it's to a large extent that people feel that in some way it's a threat to their own personal beliefs. So often I hear people who say, well, evolution is really out to destroy my belief in a creator. And that person could be a Muslim, could be a Christian, could be a Jew or whatever. And in fact, really, evolution is just a scientific way of understanding the world around us from a scientific perspective. For example, the theory of gravitation is also very complicated. And in fact, it's even more complicated because I don't understand all those formulas. But we know that every time that we let that cell phone slip out of our hands, it's going to fall to the ground. And the theory of gravitation predicts that. And the theory of gravitation says that there are forces of attraction between two objects. And when you work your way through all of Newton's and other formulas, you begin to understand that it is just simply a way of explaining a natural phenomenon, what's going on around us. There isn't anything evil. There isn't anything good about gravity. I suppose you could say it's evil if your grandmother's, you know, vase from Dresden falls off the shelf and smashes in the middle of an earthquake. But there's nothing deliberately evil about that. It's just an event. It's just an occurrence, an observable fact. And I think that people need to understand that evolution is an attempt to understand the biological basis of life, why we need to be immunized, why some people get malaria and other people don't get malaria, why it's so important not to overdo antibiotics every time you go to your doctor. And when you look at it in that sort of a framework, that it really is a explanatory model and a predictive model. For example, when Darwin predicted that Africa would be the homeland for humanity, not a single fossil had been found in Africa. He predicted that on the basis of the similarities between chimpanzees and ourselves. And it wasn't until long after he was dead, in 1924, that the first fossil was found. So that evolution is really a theory. It's an explanatory theory. It's something that explains how life is today, and in no way should it be considered a threat to anybody's faith. And I think when people begin to understand that, that we are trying to use a scientific approach to understand the diversity of life, it is a way of knowing. It is not a way of trying to chip away at someone's faith.
Why do you think the anti-evolutionists have gained so much traction?
Well, I suspect part of it has to do with the fact that they are very vocal and that they really present only one side of the story. And the side of the story that they project is really one that is an attack on evolution without giving most evolutionary biologists an opportunity to go out and present their side of the story. I just came from a wonderful meeting in Los Angeles. It was a meeting that was called What Makes Us Human? And we had clergymen. We had people talking about the concept of the soul. We had geneticists who actually count genes and do gene sequencing. We have scientists there who are trying to understand how the brain works, how we came to have language, and people like myself who are looking at the actual fossil evidence of our origins. And I believe this organization is called the Vision Organization. The Templeton Organization is another one. But these are organizations that are trying to present both sides of the issue and to show that there are many scientists who are comfortable working as biologists, working as evolutionists, who still retain a very strong personally held belief in a divine creator. So I think that it's probably because so many people become polarized when they listen to only one side of the story, whether it has something to do with the economic basis that our whole economy is going to collapse, and we read this all the time on Marketplace or something or other, that maybe the American economy is changing dramatically in a direction that cannot be turned around. You need to read the other side of the page and to learn about the strengths of our economy, learn about the strengths of our country, learn about the strengths of our resources here. So I think it probably, Carol, has a lot to do with the fact that some people don't ever have an opportunity to hear the other side.
Tell me about the Institute of Human Origins.
Well, the Institute of Human Origins is located at Arizona State University. I was its founder way back in 1981. And it's a sort of an evolutionary think tank. It's a place where we try to understand the origins of humankind from its very earliest beginnings right on up to the emergence of ourselves, Homo sapiens. There are a group of really dedicated scientists, including myself and others who work predominantly, but not exclusively, in Africa, who are trying to piece together this incredibly interesting story of where we came from. I had the great privilege of talking at Rhodes College, and I had an opportunity to talk about the results of that research, and we did not have an empty seat in the house. And afterwards, one of the most rewarding things that was said, I think, after that, was a young girl, an undergraduate at Rhodes College, came up to me and she said, "You know, I really think there is something to this evolution, and I'm so glad that I came here tonight to listen to you."
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Dr. Donald Johanson. He's professor and holds the Virginia M. Ullman Chair in Human Origins at Arizona State University and is director of the Institute of Human Origins. You've written that we are an unprecedented and totally unanticipated species. Is that true of all species?
I think each and every species is unique. We're the only ones who can really express that. We're the only ones who can really say that we are unprecedented. There has never been a creature on this planet. There's not a creature we know in our solar system. And there are some people who think that we may, in fact, be alone in the universe. There's no other creature that has this ability to ponder its past, to question itself, to go out and find the evidence of its origins and provide an explanation for at least how we got here over the last 6 to 8 million years.
And what about unanticipated?
Well, unanticipated, and what I meant by that was that if we go back and look at the group of animals to which we belong, they're called primates, and these include little lemurs that live on Madagascar, monkeys, apes, and humans. Almost every single one of them is a vegetarian, and they have developed various specializations in their teeth and their jaws and their muscles and the shape of their skull, their digestive system, and so on, to process some kind of vegetation. Humans, on the other hand, our major break came when we began to develop rudimentary, very simple, but effective stone tools, and this led us in a totally unprecedented direction towards becoming omnivores, meat and vegetation. So if you asked Lucy 3.2 million years ago, if we could have her on the show, and say, "Where do you think you're going as a species?" she probably would have responded and said, "Well, you know, we'll just get bigger teeth and bigger jaws and be able to process more vegetation." And by and large, she would be correct. But I'll bet she never would have predicted that we would be sitting here talking on a radio show about our origins.
What are the great unsolved mysteries of human origins?
Well, I think one of the major unsolved questions is the origin of our own genus. We belong, everybody has two names in this world, okay? All species have two names, like Canis domesticus, the dog, or Felis familiaris, and so on. So that dogs and cats have two names, and we have two names. We're called Homo sapiens. And Homo is from the Latin, which means man, and it's usually associated with the enlargement of the brain. And we have very, very few fossils of early Homo in the fossil record. It happened somewhere between 2.5 and 3 million years ago. There was a major shift. I think it was associated with a climate change. particularly with the fact that glaciers were locking up water in the northern hemispheres, and there was major and dramatic lowering of temperature and drying of the forests in sub-Saharan Africa, and this provided a challenge for our early ancestors. And some of them met that challenge and began to carve out a new way to live in that world by beginning to scavenge and hunt. And the origins of that genus, the origins of Homo, ourselves, is still one of the mysteries that we're trying to solve.
Are we close to finding answers?
Well, we're beginning to get glimpses. We had a wonderful discovery in Ethiopia a number of years ago, a complete upper jaw that clearly is not Lucy. It belongs in our genus. It's associated with tools, the kind of tools that most listeners would say, hey, listen, I got chips like this in my driveway. I mean, these are tools. Well, when you look at them closely, and if you're an archaeologist and you know exactly how they were made, you see that it took a purposeful hand to strike one flake off of a block to develop a cutting edge and to begin to cut into an animal. So we are beginning to narrow the time. Let's say 10, 15 years ago, we thought it was anywhere between 2 and maybe 4 million years ago. Now we know that the critical time when this happened was between 2.5 and 3 million years ago. So people are out there looking for geological strata of that age in Africa's Great Rift Valley to understand what it was that happened that made us so different from Lucy.
What is the most promising work taking place now?
Well, I think some of the most promising work in paleoanthropology and the study of human origins that's going on is going on in southern Africa. A colleague of mine, Curtis Marion, who has been working east of Cape Town. Well, Curtis Marion is digging up evidence as old as 160,000 years of tools and the use of ochre and things that don't appear in Europe until 40,000 years ago. He's pushing back the origins of modern humans 4 times over what we thought before. I think this is some of the most promising work. The geneticists are showing us that if we look at genetic variation in our genome, it looks like we went through what is called a bottleneck, that there was a large population, something constricted that population, probably climatic change, and out of the neck, the bottleneck, came very few founding individuals, and that might very well have happened in southern Africa. And the date that the geneticists have calculated based on genetic similarities and divergences is about 150,000, 160,000 years ago. So this is an extraordinarily interesting time for us.
Don, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Well, thank you, Carol. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Donald Johansson is the Virginia M. Ullman Chair in Human Origins and Director of the Institute of Human Origins. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. City View's commentator Walker Smith is thinking about chance. A tragedy reminded him that we all have close calls every day, many that we don't even know about.
You may have noticed during postseason play this year that the University of North Carolina basketball team was wearing a blue patch on their uniforms bearing the word Eve. They are wearing it in remembrance of Eve Carson, the North Carolina student body president who was found murdered on March 5th at an intersection near the house she shared with roommates a few blocks from the UNC campus. This terrible tragedy shook the entire UNC community. Details are murky, but it seems that Eve left early for campus that morning and was killed by 2 paroled felons who were cruising around looking for someone to rob. It's impossible to say at this point exactly what sequence of events led to her death, but what is tragically clear is that Eve had unfortunate timing. Had she left 30 minutes or perhaps even 10 minutes earlier or later, it's likely that she would not have crossed paths with her murderers. If she had stayed home a little longer or left a little sooner, she would have sidestepped that fate, and she would never have known it. I confess that Eve's death has been on my mind. Eve's ill-fated death has made me realize that in a profound way we are all like Eve. But for the mere chance of timing, there go we too. In quantum physics, scientists talk about parallel universes, or the alternative realities in which all the unrealized possibilities in our lives actually came true. Choices we never make get made, and the consequences of those choices are realized. This is a big idea in physics, way too big for me to fathom. Still, it's an idea that echoes with me when I think about Eve Carson. The possibilities in our lives all portend different eventualities. Some of these are significant choices, like college, marriage, and career. Others are choices we never stop to consider, like when to leave the house for school. But every choice, big or small, can have profound consequences. Usually, though, we never know how lucky we are, because the one choice in a million that could hurt us is the one choice we never make. Without realizing it, we have all left home a bit too late or too early to cross paths with the ill-timed speeding car or icy step or momentary distraction or perhaps even the lurking killer. We are thriving today because there have been days that we have luckily, yet completely unknowingly, avoided a calamity that came true only in a parallel universe. Every day of continued well-being in this universe is a gift. A few different choices, even about minor things, and misfortune would have befallen us, just as it did Eve Carson. It goes without saying that life is precious and fragile. But maybe we should remind ourselves now and again that life is also an endless confluence of events, and that every intersection we negotiate successfully is worth giving thanks, even when we don't realize just how lucky we were. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Isari is our producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.